Recording?
Yeah, recording.
This is Mom's Basement Podcast episode, not 40, 41. I was 41. Gone last week.
Yeah, and... where we get to answer the most important question. If a Swede falls down in the woods and no one hears it, does it really exist?
Does it make a sound?
Well, that we have a guest today, Wilhelm from Sweden. It's not exclusively an English language podcast, then.
You are cutting out a bit now. Do you read me clearly?
Yes, I read you clearly.
Okay. Yes, hello, and good morning.
How's it going, Wilhelm?
It's going fine, thank you. How's it going over there? I understand that you had to rise early this morning to record this.
Well, early if you're like us and you get up really late. Yeah. On the East Coast, here, it's a little after 11 o'clock. Now, we're used to recording a podcast at 10 p.m. Eastern time, so it's 12 hours different from what we would usually do, but not ridiculously early. Alex, however, on the West Coast, I understand, had to get up pretty early.
Yeah. 8 in the morning, all I needed to do was do my battle meditation. And I was good.
Nice.
So, Wilhelm, I wanted to give you the opportunity before we really delved into any discussion to talk about your podcast a little bit.
Okay. I'm doing this Swedish podcast called Nord Nordost, which basically means North by Northeast. And then I got some English-speaking friends in real life, and we started playing in English. So then I did an actual play recording in English. Mm-hmm. And it got a rather good reception. So I continued doing some episodes in English. Not all of them, but some of them. Mm-hmm. And I met with Alex when I wanted to do a recording of people from other countries to hear what gaming is like in, well, everywhere else than Sweden, then.
Yeah. I was looking over your podcast this morning. I had a really cool idea, and I've done it before, that I am trying to get a global perspective on gaming. It's, you know, even within the indie community, which is pretty diverse, you know, it seems like people tend to categorize games or hardware. It doesn't like there's
You are cutting out so much. I can't hear your question.
Yeah, you're cutting out a little bit.
It's just like listening to a robot voice somewhere in the distance. I hear your other guys perfectly fine. It's just
The worst part is, though, is even though you're hearing that, it would have sounded completely normal when the recording was done.
Yeah,
because that's how it works. Yeah, William's gone, he's offline now, so he's having internet problems because he had to be in New Hampshire for something. You know, we should get to the bottom line of what the hell he's doing in New Hampshire.
He was running for ghosts.
Well, you know, that was the cover story, but he's in there looking for an apartment of some sort, investigating an apartment.
Right.
So, in New Hampshire.
Yeah, in New Hampshire. I tacked on the
podcast story. Then.
So geez, but yeah. While he gets back on, what I really wanted to discuss with you, since you know you're from across the seas, your ways and customs are different than ours. I wanted to discuss maybe a few differences that we have in between the indie community, and see how we can, you know, see how things are different.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, so one of the most important things is the style of diversity, because I know some of the foreigners have the weird style of gaming where, like, you know, it could be a game about, you know, gathering fish or cloning each other, and, you know, I've seen some Canadian cartoons. Some of them are pretty wild and crazy. So, you know, just give us an example of some of the styles that are the, like, the popular games that are going on in your country.
LARPs are rather popular. I'm not a LARPer myself, but they're even on TV here.
Oh, wow, really?
Can you give us some detail? You know, throw us a bone here, because your ways confuse us.
We had this television program called Barda, which basically was take kids into the forest and do LARPs with them, and then show it on TV as ordinary children's programming.
Well, that sounds awesome.
But what I was trying to ask here is, like, what kind of styles of LARPing? Is it mainly, like, you know, Vampire the Masquerade? Is it just a whole different, you know, series of games? Like, what kind of LARPing?
At least there used to be a strong following for the Vampire LARPs. I don't know if it's still that way. Fantasy is very popular. Generic, go out in the forest camping and put on pointy ears. And then there are other kinds of games as well. We play Dungeons and Dragons,
mm-hmm.
the ordinary kind. There are a lot of Swedish games that haven't been translated into English, and we play those as well, of course. Mm-hmm. In the south, we have the Jeep movement. I've heard you mention it.
Yeah, we're big fans of Jeep here.
Yeah, and the Jeep, together with the Fastaval culture from Denmark, it's suddenly called Nordic gaming. And that irks me a bit since, well, I don't play that way and I'm still Nordic in a way, but...
Yeah, it's that whole issue of labeling things when the label doesn't mean a damn thing.
Yeah. And it looks like Will is back online here.
Anyways, let's finish off just a quick of those questions here. Basically, what I wanted to get at was, you know, I wanted to understand the diversity of some of the of some of the games that are going on with your with your neck of the woods, because, you know, in America, the standard of you know, the major publisher games typically revolve around either Pathfinder, Dungeons and Dragons, and that's pretty much it. Like, you get your Vampire the Masquerade kind of people, but they're a small minority now. They're not as prevalent as they used to be. And since you told us that in Sweden they do the quite a bit of LARPing there, what other styles of games that are very prevalent with your peoples?
I don't know if there's this day any game that dominates that much. Back in the 80s and 90s, we had Drakar och Demoner, which was a basic role-playing fantasy game. And everyone played that. But that company went under. So people moved on to other things. So it's a much more diverse scene here these days. Of course, we have people playing Dungeons and Dragons and Pathfinder, and the old school revolution is here as well. And then we have the Swedish games and other English games as well. I can't say that one single game is the most popular, because there are so many different games that people play. And we can pick and choose from English language games, because we learn English in school, so that's not a problem. So we have everything that you have, and then some.
Okay, so would you say that, because there's so many choices out there for you guys, that there isn't really one king to rule them all?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's very important to understand, because that definitely that can hinder and expand people's way of how they role play. Will's back on. Hopefully, this will be our our once more with feeling test of getting him on here, and some good things will happen. But those questions were pretty good so far. I liked your answers. Hopefully, he has something else to say.
I understand that it's quite different from the way that the gaming scene looks in the States, because you have Dungeons and Dragons, and, well, not everyone, but almost everyone speaks Dungeons and Dragons, and they only speak of Dungeons and Dragons. And if you play something other than Dungeons and Dragons, or maybe Pathfinder these days, you are sort of fringe
mm-hmm.
already at that stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the great Red Ryder once said, the lunatic fringe. That was an 80s song, Wilhelm. I'm just letting you know that. All right, come on, Will. This is the first time we're actually going to do some editing here, because this is taking too long to get everything back to normal here. I'm sorry about that, Wilhelm.
That's no problem. No problem at all.
Fudge. All right.
editing and such. I usually record twice as much as I keep in the final podcast, so.
Okay. No, yeah. So it looks like Williams, he's not going to be speaking to us anytime soon. He's having too much. He's having too much trouble. So it's going to be a solo episode now, from now on. At least while he's in New Hampshire. Yeah, a double feature, instead of a triple act. okay. So let's just, going off of that, going off the the style of games that you guys play. What is typically the style of community that goes on there?
We have a convention culture that is very different from yours. We can go into that later. And okay. If I look into English language gaming forums, there are loads of different ones. There's RPGNet, there's N-World, and so on and so on. In Sweden, we only have one forum that's big in a way. If you're an internet geek and you're a role player, you are on that forum. That makes it easy to communicate with, basically all gamers. A bit of an exaggeration, because not every gamer is on that forum, but if you're on a forum, then you would be on that forum. So.
And how large is that forum? Is it it's pretty good size? I mean,
thousands of users. Just a few hundred active at any moment, but historically they've been thousands of users.
That's cool. Yeah.
It's been around for over 10 years now, so.
Yeah, that's interesting that you have kind of one central location for RPGs, since the American, I guess, and Western community is kind of fragmented.
Well, why would you think that would be a possibility, Wilhelm? Is it just because of the size of the location? Is what do you think would be the reasoning behind that sort of thing happening?
I'm not sure, actually. There are other forums where you could discuss role-playing games.
What we were talking about was why would you think that there is a one forum to rule them all? Why would there be pretty much a central location? Because in the U.S. there's pretty much is no central location. There's at least five different forums that are semi-popular, instead of having one extremely popular forum.
Yeah. I think it was the first forum to reach critical mass, and then it sort of just absorbed the others. Well, at least they're all discussions. There are still other forums remaining out there, but
of course.
Discussion.
All right, so it's more like a bandwagon effect, but it's a bandwagon effect that lasts for a decade.
Absolutely.
What forum are we talking about?
Rollspel.nu. We could put a link in the show notes to a Google Translate version of the forum.
Now, are we still recording the show?
Oh, yeah, we just kept going without you, but we're actually going to be doing some editing with this thing. We're going to be cutting out the long bits. And also the mass. So, yeah, that's what we're going to be doing.
Speaking of Google Translate, I listened to the Game Chef episode you did a while back.
Mm-hmm.
And you read the Italian games through Google Translate. And that is so awesome. Quality that has opened to our community in just these last few years. Right. 10 years ago, if you wanted to read an Italian game, you had to, learn Italian then, or wait for someone else to translate it. Now you can go there, download it, translate it yourself to Google, and you can see what are the Italians up to.
Yeah, they definitely improved Google Translate quite a bit, because it used to be where they would use the standard practices of screwing up the order of someone's language. So the pretense and the after kind of stuff, the basic grammar stuff for English, where it would be reversed and they wouldn't correct it. And now they've gotten quite a bit of that done. So languages like Spanish and all that kind of stuff, a lot of them have improved dramatically.
Swedish is still a bit shaky, but it can do it. If you're willing to accept some strange words and some strange grammar, you can read Swedish through Google Translate these days.
Yeah, I actually read some of the Italian games, and it was pretty okay for me. Some of them translated better than others, but...
Yeah.
And it definitely helps to know the domain. You know, oh, this is a game, I know gaming, and what's this game about? So you can often guess what they're meaning, even if you don't understand that very sentence.
Right.
It did vary a lot from game to game, and if a game's mechanics were particularly strange or unique, then it made it difficult to try to puzzle out what exactly they were saying, because you didn't have that foundation of past knowledge to build on.
And this possibility is something that I really love and something I burn for. Because I'm doing a podcast and I want to talk to gamers from, well, around the world. What's gaming like in Switzerland? What's gaming like in Germany? What's gaming like in whatever? And I can actually go to these places and I can check out their forums and I can look at the game publishers' sites and see what are they up to. And then I can talk to people from those locations about those games.
So have you discovered anything interesting doing that? Anything really fascinating that you didn't expect to find?
I have come in contact with some German games, one called Western City. That's even has been translated to English, but I didn't know about it at all. And then I spoke to some German gamers, and they mentioned, oh, you should read this awesome German game called Western City. And I didn't even know about that game. There are so many games these days, and you really have to know someone who can recommend games, or otherwise you will never learn about all these awesome games that just wait out there.
Right. I mean, the community is global and it's huge. And the thing is that almost everyone in it is not just a player of role-playing games. They're a designer of role-playing games. So there's, you know, as many games as there are people, and even more since a number of people design multiple games. So there's so much to sort through. And I think that's something that's difficult, is really finding the games that you would like to play. There's not... Aside from saying, oh, you know, this gaming style or this gaming culture is something that really interests me. Like, say, I'm really into Jeep, or I'm really into this particular Western style game. You know, I'm really into Apocalypse World hacks or something. You can say that, and then that can help you navigate the community a little bit. But it seems like there is no real easy way to discover the games that you're really looking for. Especially if there's an ocean between you and the games that you like to play, which is something that's sort of true of me. I find that a lot of what's going on in Europe in terms of design technique and styles is a lot more interesting to me than what's going on in the American design community for a lot of reasons that maybe we'll get into later. And since I'm not really tied into the European indie game community very tightly, it's more difficult for me to find games that, you know, the games that would really fascinate me, which is one reason why I really loved the fact that they added the Italian language games to Game Chef. I felt like there was so much cool shit going on in those 15 games, and it was just refreshing to see, which is why several of them ended up on my list. So, I kind of jumped into the middle of this year, and I'm not sure what ground has or hasn't been covered, but...
We discussed the Battle of the Baltics and the Treaty of Verney.
Well, thank you,
in
Alex.
In gaming.
Right.
In gaming, yeah.
Thank you, Alex, for being as candid and useful as ever, and never being a troll.
No, what we talked about was I asked him a few questions about like the style of games that are usually being played over there, and a little bit about the community before you came back in.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool. So I'm really still into this idea of interviewing gamers, you know, worldwide. About how many people have you interviewed so far, and what kind of differences in styles have you discovered just from the interviews you've done?
Well, the project is still in a rather early phase. Mm-hmm. So I've interviewed two people, and one of them was Vivian from the United States, and I mm-hmm. think you can guess what her style was then. And then I interviewed Alex from Switzerland, and he didn't actually play with Swiss people. He lived in Zurich, and pretty much all in people in his gaming group were also foreigners living in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have great hopes for the future, but I don't think I can have something substantial to report just yet.
Okay, that's totally understandable. Right. Now, just out of curiosity, what part of the U.S. was Vivian from? Because I know there's a big kind of urban-rural divide in the U.S., and there's even sort of little regional pockets. You know, it's such a huge country that there's so many different approaches, and there's so many different gaming communities.
I think that Vivian was from Boston.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
If I recall correctly, she said that particular city had a large contingent of female gamers. So if you were a female role player, that was a good place to live because you could find other female gamers to play with.
Right. I also hear that Boston is kind of the hotbed of the indie gaming community in the U.S. I hear that indie gaming, that's sort of, indie gaming is obviously spread all across the country, but it seems like there's a higher concentration of indie gamers there, from what I've heard. I don't know if she mentioned that. Do you think that's true?
I have no idea, actually.
Okay.
But I think that once you get a few indie gamers in an area, that will spread. They will, like the Borg, assimilate people into their style.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true. I only ask because Rudy and I are actually from upstate New York, way upstate New York, and it's a wasteland, you know. Yeah,
there's literally nothing up here.
Yeah, Rudy, you can describe the trials we've had.
Well, we have a small group, but and we've been kind of trying to get them into indie games, and it's been, they've responded pretty well, but it's difficult to actually find other people. It's really impossible because there's no like gamer networks or anything like that up here that are active. You know, there's the internet, but the closest people to us are like maybe 50 miles away or more. So it's kind of difficult to actually get, you know, new members of the community here.
Seems like you're trying to cannibalize other kinds of gamers into your preferred style. Have you tried to find people you like hanging out with and making them into gamers instead of finding gamers that you like? And
yeah, that's pretty much how it is.
But yeah, I mean, that's something we've tried to do, and in fact, you know, when we first started playing way, way back, years and years ago, when we started with D&D, like most people start with, you know, it was just a group of people who hadn't played before, just friends, you know, getting together, and friends and my sister really sitting down at the table and playing. Now that's a little bit more difficult, I think, because we've pretty much worked our social network, you know, limited as it is, to death.
Yeah.
And I think that's become really cool. And there is a real divide there, though, between, I think people have a certain comfort zone when it comes to gaming, and the farther you get out on the fringes, the more difficult it is to find people who are still within that comfort zone, you know. You can always find someone who will play Xbox with you, you know. And it's not too hard to find someone who might play Magic the Gathering with you. It's a little harder to find someone who might play Dungeons and Dragons with you. And then when you get to, like, Jeep Forum, it's like no one will touch it.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, and I think that's a function, really, of being in a very rural community. And so I guess this is my way of saying this is an example of how things are different in the U.S., in different parts of the U.S. But I'm relocating to Manchester, New Hampshire, which is just about an hour bus ride north of Boston soon. So that should be less of a problem for me soon.
So wait, you were investigating ghosts in New Hampshire to move into?
Yes, I'm moving into a ghost, Alex. I'm being, what is that, reverse possession?
Yeah, Yeah, I guess it'd be like, boy, I don't know, like ghost osmosis or something.
Right, you're possessing the ghost as opposed to the ghost possessing you.
No. What I was saying, because I was just joking about like you going to an apartment in New Hampshire and you were investigating for ghosts, mm-hmm. and I didn't know that was real.
Well, you did know that I was going to New Hampshire.
Yeah, but I didn't know it. I didn't know it was actually to move into an apartment. I thought you were just doing being weird or something like that.
Oh no, yeah, I'm moving.
Okay.
So
not ready.
So now indie games is a very broad title, right? Let's go into that definition war.
Yes, let's do that.
No, let's not go into the definition
war. Your kind of indie gaming is not my kind of indie gaming. You know that?
Right. Instead of going into that definition war, though, let's go into the specifics of the kinds of games we like to play.
Yes.
You know, what kind of features do we like our indie games to have? Because all of us here, even antagonistic Alex, play indie games, like indie games. And I just want to see, like, what is it, what draws you to indie games? What's cool about them? You know, what is it that really gets you going? And anyone can start this.
All right, well, I guess for me, it's the subject matter that a lot of indie games cover that just the published games, or not the published games, but the, you know, trade games don't really get to. Like,
examples, please?
Yeah, like, for example, like, say, the Jeep Forum games that are more character-focused and less about, you know, statistics and that kind of stuff. Those games, you don't really see. I mean, you can do that with the trade games, and, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people do, but the Jeep Forum games are basically built and designed to do that, and you don't see that a lot in the American RPG community as far as the trade games.
So you're talking style then, play style.
Yeah.
Are you also talking subject matter though? Are you also talking about the types of topics these games are willing to broach?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time trade games and stuff are basically just fantasy or you know, like vampires or whatever. But a lot of indie games go into more, I guess, kind of real life topics like let's say abuse and, you know, hardships and that kind of stuff that I think is really juicy for gaming. And it's kind of like an unmined type of area because the trade games don't really cover it that much.
Okay. What's an example of a indie game that really you feel really goes there and really hits the sweet spot for you?
I was going to say the Jeep Forum game. I think it's called Drunk. I've never played it, but I read it online, and it's basically about like the effects of alcoholism on a group of people, and it's very character focused, and it's very much a game that that covers, I guess, difficult subject matter.
Hmm.
But it seems like it would still be fun to play, and I think that's pretty important to have games that they're interesting as games, as well as, you know, social vehicles or other types of things.
Right, absolutely. Oh, sorry, did I cut you off?
Nope.
Okay. Wilhelm, so what is it about indie games that really gets you interested? And I know it's a big question, but
yeah. Staying away from the definition of what is indie and so on.
Right.
Most of these games are rather short. Mm. If you go to IPR and buy a random indie title, you usually end up with a book that's 50 pages, 64 pages, 30 pages, something like that.
Right.
And you can take that, sit down and play, and your story is done that evening. You and your friends sit down for 4 hours, and then you're done. You can put the game away, you reach the story to its conclusion, you don't have to open that book again.
Right.
And those are factors that attract me a lot. I don't have that much free time anymore that
right.
I used to do when I was younger. And my friends are busier. It's rare to find the people that can commit to a full-length campaign. But they can, I can come for one evening or two evenings and we can play a game. So most of these intertitles suit me very well for where I am in life right now. Busy, that is.
Right. Mm-hmm. So being self-contained is a big deal then.
Yeah, self-contained and quick read. Right. I can't spend 8 or 12 hours learning and prepping a game, but maybe half an hour or an hour, read the game, print the character sheets, and we sit down and we play.
Right, so yeah.
Even if we don't count, usually don't count the old school revolution or old school renaissance into indie gaming, I still play Swords and Wizardry because it appeals in the same way. We play a game, we meet every couple of weeks and play for 3 hours, a single dungeon, and it works out very well. So,
I'm totally with you there. And that's one thing that definitely appeals to me, too, about indie gaming, is the fact that so many of these titles are self-contained. I mean, I love a long, extended campaign as much as anyone, if it's possible, if you can handle the logistics of that. But the fact that you can pick up and play a game, and even if you decide to play it again, you know, you can have the full experience in the evening, in one evening, excuse me. And if you do decide to pick it up and play it again, you can have a completely new experience with the same rule set, with even the same scenario. And I think that idea of really being able to experience the same thing twice and get very different results, just by tweaking a few little details in the game, really reveals something about gaming that you don't necessarily see when you have, you know, a big game that's intended to be played, you know, a number of sessions, and that has so many different options and so many different features and so many bits and pieces, then, yes, it's always a different game each time, but you expect it to be. To be able to see something, a totally new perspective, you know, taking a small object and just spinning it around and seeing something totally new when you do that, I think is revealing in a way that taking a big game and playing it a bunch of times isn't. So I think that's cool. But what about subject matter, Wilhelm? What kind of, are there things that indie games do in terms of the type of topics they broach or the type of, the type of things that they get at that is appealing to you, or is it purely just the logistics of indie games?
As I have grown older, I am less and less appealed of fighting in games.
Mm-hmm.
The turn-based damage roll, initiative roll kind of deal. We still do that in Swords and Wizardry, of course, but I find that appealing to me less and less. And most of these games introduce conflict resolution instead of like task resolution. So they make things easier and quicker.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true of me as well. You know, the appeal of spending 20 minutes to kill 3 kobolds or something diminishes with time. Alex, unless Wilhelm, did you have anything that you wanted to say about what's appealing to you? What makes indie games appealing to you before I get Alex in here? I'm trying to establish a baseline here. Sorry.
We'll let Alex in.
Okay. Alex.
Well, thank you guys for letting me in this conversation. I mean,
no problem.
Anyways, okay. Get into the real talk. I come from I've said last week. I basically come from narrative wargaming, so the concept of me acting out characters and whatnot is not, you know, it's not strange or unfamiliar to me. Basically, instead of playing with a man doll, I become the man doll.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, so a lot of the times the scenario is not that different, not that intense for me to figure out. And the main reason why I've gotten into indie games is just because, you know, they're games to me. So some of them have different aspects that I like, some I don't like, and what I do like in general is I like the simplification of a lot of the conflicts, because I'm used to like an 80-page manual describing how to actually attack somebody and not actually get something done. So the concept of having like a 10-page manual telling you how to finish everything off, like, you know, as in, you know, you roll this, this is your answer, you're done, is refreshing. And that's what I would like to do whenever I, you know, play some of those games.
Have you played Zombie Cinema?
I have not played the Zombie Cinema. What's so special about that one?
The rules fit on a single sheet. in the last few years, that is the game that I have played the most. Mm. Both with beginners. We often go to conventions and do demos of indie games. Both with beginners and when we play back home with the indie veterans, we still play Zombie Cinema once in a while because it's still a solid game.
Well, the thing that gets me, like, you know, going deeper in thought about this is, you know, because I've had such a history with, you know, complex, advanced, you know, systems of, you know, calculating the rate of fire for your machine gun and crap like that. It makes it to where, like, basically, like, the less rules, the less complication is good because it just removes a lot of the frustration a lot of the war gamers have with their own game. Mm-hmm. And basically what I was trying to get at is I like the simplification, but I also don't like just severely simple games in terms of, like the resolution mechanic. I don't really like... you're kind of like how D&D has it, where it's just add, you get your answer. You know, you stack your answers in order to get something, in order to get the target number. I really don't care for those kind of scenario, you know, mechanics. Anytime where, you know, and that's why all of my games that I've, you know, talked to you guys about don't rely on just pure, you know, rolling for your, you know, target number and winning that. A lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of my games revolve around, like a mixture of the sorts, to where you it's not severely simplistic. You can't really. I basically don't like the min-maxing capabilities of games, because you get the most of the worst members of your community in there by having those min-maxers. And so yeah, that's what I tend to go for. I don't like any of those styles of games where, if you can focus on like working your magic and becoming the you know, a +22, you know, barbarian at level 1. I don't care for that kind of nonsense.
Right. You know, I totally agree with you. I do like competition in games, but I don't like that kind of competition in games. I like social competition in games, because that's the level that the game exists at any right way, right? It exists at the social level. It exists in conversation and in performance. And if you can turn that competitive in a way that doesn't become... that doesn't inhibit people, which is something you have to worry about, or become, you know, that doesn't stifle the game, then I think they can be very fascinating, because there's always a little bit of that one-upsmanship going on under the surface, and if you can tap into that in a way that makes people feel more liberated and makes people get into the game more, I think there's something really cool potentially about that. But I agree with you, when that competition is taking place on the character sheet, more so than in play, and in the book, then you lost me.
Well, because the main problem with that style of gaming is it's a one-upsmanship that's divorced of the rest of the group.
Right.
It has no... There's no point of it even being there. If you're going to be that focused on making a character badass, you know, play by yourself and get, like, an adventure book to tell you where you're going to go. Because the rest of the people around you don't want to play that. They don't want to even be bothered playing with the guy who's pretending to be James Bond and has the stats of James Bond.
Right.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, no, Wilhelm.
I'd have to agree with that, too, because I do like mechanically focused games, but as William said, only if the game's mechanics expand the social nature of the game. And that I think is really important, that you have mechanics that aren't divorced from the social situation, as well as, you know, being interesting and that kind of stuff.
Wilhelm?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. I thought maybe you'd want to jump in on that conversation.
Could you phrase that as a question?
Sure.
Because...
Yeah, I know. It's kind of been amorphous, all over the place discussion. I guess the question is, how do you feel about competition in games, either min-max competition like Alex was talking about or social competition? Like, what do you feel about the role of competition in indie role-playing games?
I don't mind competition as such, but and I wrote a competitive role-playing game back a while, so I don't mind it as such, but I don't like it when it gets in the way of the game. So if you're playing, whatever, Dungeons & Dragons, and there's one min-maxer in the group and the others are like role players, you will have a mismatch and you will not have fun.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So as long as everyone is on board and are playing in the same style, then I'm fine with it. But when you get conflicting styles, then when I see a problem.
So how about games that do that well, that do competition well? Any examples from any of you? You know, Alex has already said D&D doesn't do it well, and I agree. D&D generally doesn't do it well because, like Alex said, that competition is happening outside of the realm of the game a lot of the time. It's happening in someone's bedroom before they play the game when they're making their character sheet. But examples of games that do it well, that get people, where the competition really draws people into the game.
You were talking about games where you can compete on a social level, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I point at Zombie Cinema again, because that game is the answer to every question. you create your character, of course, but you do that by drawing three cards at random, and they don't have any mechanical impact on the game. Then you start playing, and whenever there's a conflict, everyone rolls d6. Whoever rolls the highest win. If there's a tie for the win, the zombies attack and abort the whatever you were discussing. And the trick to the game is to escape. You will survive this zombie infestation. Mm-hmm. And you do that by winning conflicts. And to win conflicts, to increase your odds of winning, you have to find allies who will join you and help you and take your side in this conflict. So you can play that like a diplomacy role-playing game if you want to. Or you can lean back and just play it like a whatever storytelling narrative role-playing game and only do what your character would do. And those kind of players can sort of interact within the game without getting in each other's way.
Oh, that is really interesting. And I think that gets at what's really going on in a lot of these zombie films and zombie TV shows, you know, where it's half character study and half zombie violence, you know. And I think that sometimes games lose the character study part of that. That's cool. Maybe we'll have to play test that. Do an actual, well, not an actual play, but do record, play test it and then do a recording talking about it like we've done with other games on Mom's Basement. I think that's something that Rudy, Alex, and I could really get into. Alex, Rudy.
I just wanted to go off that for a second. Yeah. I really like the idea that in order to, withstand a zombie attack, you have to have your own zombie horde. But they're just human zombie hordes.
Oh, you mean in zombie movies?
Yeah, as in, like, in order for you to, you had to fight fire with fire. So in order for you to, you know, withstand, you know, 50 guys coming at you, but, you know, their goal is to eat you up, you have to have, you know, like, 10 to 20 guys with guns whose goal is to stop them from eating you guys. So it's horde versus horde.
Right, and who in some ways are as violent and despicable as the zombies.
Yeah.
And mindless, even. Or more, yeah.
I've always liked that with zombie-style games.
So, Rudy, yeah. Alex, examples of competitive games. Or unless you were going to come in with something else, Rudy.
Well, no, I was just going to say that game we played, I think, a couple weeks ago called God King. Mm-hmm. It's by Daniel Cruz Chan. That game has probably what I'd say is a good example of social mechanics in action. And that you have to give your trust to other players in order to kind of advance in the game. And it's about basically who you trust and who your character trusts and, you know, how that affects the group as a whole. And also there's a kind of competition because in the beginning of the game, you draw a card that tells you something secret about your character that, it tells you, like, it gives your character, like, an agenda, kind of. Mm. And that agenda might be contrary to some of the other characters in the group, which I thought was pretty cool. Because you can have, like, you can have one guy whose mission is, like, to assassinate a member of the group. And then you have another guy who, you know, has a sick kid or something, and they're trying to get, you know, medical supplies or whatever, possibly at the expense of the rest of the group. Basically, I thought that was a really cool idea. And I think that in that game, it really just serves the bigger social, I guess, picture of the game, because it's about, like, exploration and going on a mission to find the God King. And I guess what I'm saying is that games that do exploration like that, that kind of stuff is going on anyway.
Mm.
Like in Dungeons and Dragons, that kind of competition is often found. You know, sometimes you'll have a PK or something in the group who's trying to kill other group members. But this game kind of takes that and crystallizes it into a way that I think is more fun than, you know, what you often get from D&D encounters.
Right.
Other games.
Yeah, and it also builds that into the game and makes that an expectation of play.
Right.
And often in D&D and in other games where people will stake out opposing positions through their own volition, there's a sense, there will always be some players who are saying, no, you shouldn't be doing that. This game is about teamwork. This game is purely about working together. Mm-hmm. And we've got a PK in the game. What are we going to do? That guy's a pain in the ass. Because the expectations for play are so different. Here, right. One of the first things you do is you draw, he calls them truths. But you draw your truth, which is your secret agenda. And so you know from the beginning of the game that although this is a cooperative game and you're going to have to work together in order to survive, it's also going to be a competitive game and there's going to be backstabbing there. So no one walks into the game expecting just pure teamwork only to be frustrated.
Right. Yeah, I think that kind of like almost social pass is kind of good for any game that wants to do social competition, because a lot of times people are afraid to compete, you know, because they want to piss off their friends, you know, or they're afraid to, you know, act in character because they don't want to piss people off, or, you know. So I think that's a good component of any game that, you know, would try to be socially competitive or have mm-hmm. socially competitive aspects.
Okay. Alex, a game you think does it well and why? Oh, sorry, Wilhelm.
Stop.
Sorry.
Isn't that discussion that apparently was made part of the rules for God King, isn't that really fundamental for all kinds of good gaming, that you don't just rush into the game, but you stop and you discuss, what are we playing here, really? What are our objectives as players? All right, the characters may want to go and kill the dragon, but we players, what do we want to do?
Mm-hmm.
I found that once we started having that kind of discussions before we started a game, the games got so much better. They got so much interesting. We got so much more out of the games.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think some groups are hesitant to have that discussion, and it's unfortunate. And I think often, for example, if you're sitting down and playing with a group of people for the first time, especially if you're not necessarily leading the game, you know, you're kind of taking a back seat. Maybe you're playing with some people you just met at a con, or maybe you've just been, like, dropped in the middle of someone else's gaming group. It's often they won't have that discussion, and it becomes difficult to tell, you know, how am I supposed to be playing this game, and how do I play this game so that it doesn't upset anyone. So yeah, you're right. Having that discussion, I think, helps a lot, if you can have it.
Yeah. And for your home group, I think you should do it like a discussion. If you're running a game at a convention, I think it should be part of the setup that you say, all right, we are going to play this game. It's this kind of game. You will have the objective to kill the dragon, but it isn't about that. It is about the backstabbing, so that everyone, it comes in the open. Everyone knows, all right, we are playing this kind of game. And we're supposed to be doing this. then everything will flow so much smoother, and people can expect that treason, and when it becomes so much sweeter.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right. Alex? When it comes to that kind of discussion, I'm a bit of a lady when it comes to that kind of thought process, where, you know, kind of like the whole like the Valentine's Day gifts and all that kind of stuff, where you should know what my intentions are, like especially if we're friends. So this is kind of like a test within a test within a test of the actual game. Like you should know what you should have some sort of idea of what's going on with us, of what my preferences are. If you're gonna do the ultimate the ultimate show of love, and play a game with me.
I suppose you are frustrated by your co-players quite a lot.
No, I'm actually not, because my expectations are severely low. As in, like, I have no agenda going into the game. It's just like, oh, let's have a game. You know, blah, blah, blah. And that's it. So it works both ways.
Yeah.
But I've always liked the idea about that. It's like, you know, this shows me how much you love me. How much do you love me, player?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. It's a little silly, but that's usually how I roll.
I don't think I could go back to playing that way now that I have had these great experiences from having very clear discussions and open discussions, both before our game, we are going to play this, and after every game, we stay for a while and we discuss, all right, we play this, what did it feel like? Did everything work okay? Should we change something for next session? This meta discussions around the game it's at least half the game for me these days.
Oh yeah, because a lot of it has to, like, for me is I still have that magic for the game itself, and like I haven't become bitter and frustrated by like any of the problems I ever had to the point where I want to discuss what we're going to do before we actually do it. Like there may be like a discussion of like, hey buddy, we're not going to be doing so much PvP this time, and then after that we're done. Like there's no discussion of, you know, what kingdom you're from, you know, what you know, what were you like as a child in the game? You know, we don't go in depth. It's just like, hey, like, you know, if there's a topic you don't want to broach tonight, you know, just go, hey, we're not doing that tonight, so just let it go, okay, man? And then follow by sweet, and then we're done. There's no, like, actual, like, discussion of what's really going on in the world of the game. It's just done with it.
I'm not meaning necessarily a game discussion of the store game's background, but a discussion about the style of play. How will we be playing this game? Is it acceptable to betray another player? Is it acceptable to pass notes to the game master stating things that you do hidden?
Oh, okay.
Is it okay to spend half an hour negotiating with a merchant for the price of a sword, or should we just buy stuff between sessions? That kind of discussion before every game and after every session.
Okay, so do you typically not play with the same group?
Sometimes I have the regular group then. We still have these discussions because we have played games in many, many different styles, like we talked about earlier.
Okay, because like I'm sorry.
We have to make clear every time we meet. All right, we are playing a game. What style is this game? Even if the players are familiar and have preferences in all different styles. But we have this discussion before every game. All right, now we are playing this kind of game, GM, but you may not, and so on.
So I think for me, like with that kind of situation, like for that kind of discussion, it was one of those things where, again, I just feel out like what I've been able to gather from the other people, and I just go from that kind of assumption. Because like whenever I play with Will or with Rudy, I have kind of a good idea of how they're going to act in the scenario, which is why I also don't go super serious face with when we role play. I make it light and goofy because they're going to make it light and goofy as well. So, I mean, we pretty much had like an unspoken bond of how we're going to do these things. And since we're all on the same wavelength, it kind of works out. But I can totally understand like where you're coming from. I'm not like rejecting it. I'm just saying that it's just one of those things where I don't feel it's so necessary all the time to discuss. If you have an understanding of who they are, as a person, and if they kind of act that way, it's, you know, it's okay, like, not to discuss about it, because you have a good understanding of who they are and how they're going to act in the game, in terms of, like, are they more likely to backstab somebody, are they more likely, you know, to blah blah blah.
Although having that discussion anyway opens the door to playing in a completely different way. Let's say I get up next week and decide, you know, I want to do serious straight-faced drama the next time we do an actual play. If I don't say that, and I'm playing a serious dramatic character, and, you know, you're playing, I don't know, playing something ridiculous, and Rudy's playing something ridiculous because they think that's how I'm going to play the game, then there can be problems. Whereas if I just sat down and said, hey guys, why don't we try something totally different? Instead of playing a satirical game or a satirical take on this game or playing something outlandish, why don't we play something really serious, you know, some serious reflection on mundane life or something? Why don't we try that? Why don't we try to do it straight-faced? You guys might say, nah, man, I'm not into that. Or you might say, hey, yeah, sure, we haven't done that before. Let's try it. But if we don't have that discussion, that can't happen.
Well, I think that the main problem that I'm hearing from, you know, from what I heard from Wilhelm was it made it sound like half an hour discussion of, you know, talking about, like, what we expect from this game. I'm expecting less than 5 minutes of, you know, like, hey, this is what I'm looking for. You guys with me? Cool, we're done. You know, that kind of thing. I'm not expecting a very long discussion if we do have a discussion. That's what I'm hearing from you. Is that anywhere close to true, Wilhelm?
We can definitely spend half an hour doing this. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think one thing is it's important that the game's manual or its text or whatever facilitate that discussion.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times groups, like William said, are hesitant to have it. And, you know, as far as some games go, like, say, Dungeons and Dragons, like, the amount to which you could discuss it is kind of unclear, because there's so many rules and there's so many different ways to play the game. But I think if the game is more focused and, you know, actually gives some advice in the text about, you know, okay, well, before you play, these are the types of things you should discuss, and maybe briefly discuss this, and this, you know, that kind of thing. I think people would like that, would probably like that more, and would be more likely to have those kind of discussions.
Indeed.
But I guess it does vary from game to game, because, you know, mechanical complexity is different and that kind of stuff.
And if we look into indie games versus traditional games, then there is a sort of implied way how to play role-playing games that comes with all the traditional games. And we see these explanations. No, in my indie game, it is different. You should not play it like your traditional game. You should play it differently in this way. And then it becomes explicit, written in the rules. This game is played without the game master.
Right.
So I think part of the appeal of the indie games as such is that they are very clear about how this game should be played to get the same experience as the one that the author wanted to give you, system methods and so on.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So let's move towards maybe wrapping this discussion up. You know, actually, before we totally wrap up, there's something I wanted to ask, because we've been talking a lot about what makes indie games superior or what makes them appealing to us. But what are some things about either indie games or the indie game community, either very specific things or very general things, that kind of maybe turn you off, that frustrate you, that you would maybe like to see done differently? I think that's a productive conversation to have too. And whoever wants to get us started on this.
I don't want to stand behind the statement that indie games are superior.
Absolutely.
There are lots of different ways to play, and even if I may not personally like all styles equally, they are still valid and real, actual styles. Oh. And if we go on there and say, oh, indie games are superior to all other kinds of gaming, that will lead to interesting discussion, but not very productive discussions.
Right. Absolutely. No, I mean, well, I guess what I was saying was we've talked a lot about the good things about indie games. Let's have a conversation about what troubles us about them, either specifically or generally.
Well, speaking of the positives of indie games, the things that I don't like quite a bit is the pretentiousness.
Now, what is pretentiousness? Because pretentiousness, that's a word that's very much a knee-jerk reaction and means very different things to very different people. So what's pretentious to Alex
Swindle?
Well,
guess what, pal? I typed this up, like, you know, in the Googles as I was getting ready to say it, just so that way, in case this happened, because it's a definitely, just the word alone, pretentious, is usually a douchebag move to describe a group of people. Kind of like how saying you're ignorant and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
There's a lot of language that's used just to insult the other person. And one of those words is this. But anyways, the definition is attempting to impress somebody by affecting greater importance, talents, and culture than it actually has.
Mm.
And that is definitely prevalent with a lot of indie designers, which then gets spewed out into the community of indie players.
So I don't want to force you to insult anyone specifically, but what are some ways that you see this in game design, specifically in game design, not so much in how people talk about game design, which is always going to be difficult and is always going to be dangerously on the verge of pretentiousness, but in game design?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with when explaining the rules. There's definitely there are definitely different styles of informing the player how you think the game should be played. I think, you know, I'm a fan of, you know, calling people out on their crap. Let's go like Luke Crane with his burning wheel and burning empire, right? Isn't that what he did?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or basically there's a manual on how to describe what to say to each other, like what the key phrases are and crap like that. And just hearing that alone tells me that you think your game is so important that you have to make up your own language for it, your own social language.
Okay.
Small thing like Vincent Baker when he just talks about his shit, like some of the things that I read on like his like blog every now and then of how he describes what a game should be in his definition, or like how mechanics work for him, it rubs me the wrong way, and because it starts to give the impression that there's a superior method. You know, kind of like, the Ronnies, you know, Ron Edwards there or whatever. Like, where, you know, he came up with that theory of how role-playing games should be and, like, what three styles there are and crap like that. Just the idea that that's even possible for someone to waste their time and describe, you know, the diatribe, you know, the history of games and how they should all behave, and here are the different methods of game. It's, you don't see a lot of mainstream games saying it like that. Yeah. And I really dislike the amount of information that's just, like, there's so much use that could have been given by those people not trying to define what a game is and just actually making games.
Okay.
And that's my problem with it.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Rudy.
I was just going to say, I think that whereas, I think you have a point there, but, and whereas, like, traditional games tend to be focused more on the minutiae of mechanics, or they have the potential to be, you know, for that to get out of hand, I think some indie games have the potential for the minutiae of the experience kind of to get out of hand.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, as far as, you know, the game designer describing or prescribing an experience that you're supposed to have during play and people trying to play to that, I think there's a potential there for, you know, for some conflict between players, you know, who like to take it a little bit looser versus players who, you know, want to be by the manual and that's it. You know, it's kind of like in D&D where you have somebody who's like, well, we're playing in Faerun, so that wouldn't happen in Faerun. You know, that's what it reminds me of. It's like we're playing a Vincent Baker game, so that shouldn't happen in a Vincent Baker game or whatever, because the text prescribes this. you know, and I guess what I'm saying is that I don't really like game manuals that that overprescribe right. the way the experience of play should happen. I mean, I understand the designer has a vision as far as you know, whatever they want to do. But I think you can communicate that vision in ways that it doesn't sound like you're basically telling someone play it this way or it's wrong, you know.
Right. That don't seem dictatorial.
Right.
Wilhelm, do you want to weigh in on this?
I think I'm on the other side of the spectrum here.
Good, good.
Whoops. I see two different discussions here, and take them in order. The first is specific language and specific words and putting labels on things. You saw a problem in that, didn't you, Alex?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like that. Not that you dislike it, but putting labels and finding terms for things. I have played role-playing games for 25 years, something like that. And maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I met up with a group of players, and we started having these discussions before and after sessions, discussing what was good and finding words to express what we thought was good and what we didn't like. And once we started doing that, we developed our own vocabulary for the game, and it was specific to our circle, but it helped us get better experiences from the game. We got more out of the time we invested because we could speak about what we wanted. So I really, really like having these words at my disposal. Even if I read someone else's writings on role-playing games and they use a different vocabulary, I can still see, oh, they're talking about this thing that we call this, and they're meaning this. Oh, that's interesting. I can understand and relate to the discussions in a completely different way than I would have been limited to if I didn't have my own words and discussions.
And the second part of that, you said there were two things.
Yeah. The second part is this, should the game tell you how to play it? And I am a firm believer of games that are very, very clear about how this game should be played. If we do some analog here, oh, let's go to the racetrack and watch a race. And one of our party goes there and has his eyes closed the entire time because he doesn't like horses.
Mm.
And then we get out and he's like, oh, this sucked. Damn, right. This sucked. Because he wasn't ready to take the experience. He didn't know that you should watch the horses and cheer for them. And the same thing happens in games.
Yeah.
Once we were playing in the traditional style of games where games only had differences by the rule system and the setting. That's what's fine to just say, oh, this is a role-playing game, this is how you roll damage, and this is what the setting looked like. But when games started to become wider, to get a bigger range of different styles of games, I feel it was important that to actually play this game, you should have this... you should play it this way in order to experience what I want to give you. Of course, we can play Burning Empires using the Dungeons and Dragons rules. We can use that setting, but we will not get the experience that Lucrane wrote his game to give.
Yeah.
It's a lot of thing. I really love that setting. I love the comics. I like the book. I bought the only supplement. I love that as well. And I can use that in another game if I want to... experience that setting. I can take the rules and experience them, rolling damage this way, rolling conflicts this way, and they are valid and standalone in a way, but together with the form of the game, how you are supposed to play this, they become a whole, something more than the parts.
Right. And that's the goal, really, whenever you, with any design, that the pieces fit together seamlessly and you get a very cohesive whole. I wanted to jump back and say something about that pretentiousness discussion, because I don't think you can have pretentiousness, or pretension is a word that is used oftentimes by people who don't really think very much about what it means. And I'm glad that Alex did that, that he looked up the definition. Because I think that really at the core of pretentiousness is pretense. You know, that's what's important, that this be a falsehood, that there be some dishonesty in place between what you're saying and what you're thinking, or what you're saying and what you're trying to accomplish, what is written in the game's manual and what the game hopes to achieve. I think that when words in any way function as a pretense for something else, that's where the problem is. When the words are on the page either to make the designer feel better about himself or to make the designer feel like he's designing this type of game, you know, these words are on this page because it's the expectation that words be like this because this is this kind of game, as opposed to these words are on the page because I thought very carefully about my design and I decided that this was the best possible way to express this and this will get the best possible result in play. I think that's where pretentiousness comes in, is when the words are not expressing what they're intended to express, when there's that disconnect there. And I think that's where you get a concern. And I know that and the way people use the word pretentiousness sometimes bothered me. I know once a friend of Rudy and I said that he didn't watch documentaries because he felt they were pretentious. And I thought, what could be less pretentious than a documentary, assuming that it's not done from a particular point of view? You know, where could there be less pretense than in an attempt to depict life as clearly and plainly as it is? So that's what I think you need to think about when you're writing your game, is are these words here for my own are these words here because I'm, you know, as a way for me to get off, basically? Are these words here because of an expectation that these words be here? Are these words here because they're really the best possible way to express how I want this game to function?
Then I'm with you. And in a way, I agree, yeah.
The only thing that I had some disagreement with, and you know, because I'm not going to deny what you have to say, Wilhelm, because everything else, you know, I'm agreeing with. I'm okay with what you have to say there. Like, the only thing that I thought was a little strange was your analogy, because, like, you were on point, you know, with what you were trying to get at, as in, like, you know, somebody went to the racetrack expecting something else, and, you know, did not have the fun because everyone was in agreement with what was going to happen. But the thing that I disagreed with on that analogy was that what else is to do there at a horse track besides eat snacks, maybe talk to some people around the crowd and watch the race? And if your game is just watching the race, then of course the person's going to have a bad time because you are completely telling them that's all they can do. And there are quite a few systems out there that are generic to the point where you can do whatever the heck you want with it, instead of it being a focused point that everyone has to deal with. And that's all I wanted to include.
I won't defend that analogy in court. It was the spur of the moment was the best I could think of.
I just wanted to make sure it was out there, just so, you know, so that way you would know.
Absolutely. And I agree with you in your analysis there. It's that way. Then I find that most of those games that where you can do everything at the racetrack, they don't do anything very well. They do all things acceptable. And then there are maybe the indie games that say, oh, this game is about having hot dogs at the racetrack, and this is the best game for having hot dogs at the racetrack.
Yeah, jack of all trade systems versus focused systems.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm all done with that piece.
Okay, so we've got about an hour here. I think we can wrap up. Any final thoughts on indie games? Wilhelm, do you want to plug your podcast one last time? Give people the web address, give them everything they need to know to get there and listen, because I think, I don't know, I was having a lot of fun listening to this it this morning, and I think other people would as well.
All right. The address is nordnordost.se. I hope you can put this in the show notes, because it's in
Swedish.
Yeah,
I will. Right. Yeah, we'll definitely put a link up.
And it's a podcast done by me and my friends, who are gamers interested in indie games. We don't always talk about just indie games, but there's a heavy indie game focus on what we do. Many of the episodes are in Swedish. I hope you learn Swedish so you can understand them. But until that time comes, you can listen to the ones we have done in English. And there's a special link you can use to get to just the English podcast episodes. So, and I suppose we will put that on the show notes.
Absolutely. Just put those links in the messenger here, and Rudy will make sure they're included in the little blurb about the show. Okay, so all that said, any final thoughts on indie games, or any last words from everyone? We'll start with Rudy.
Nope, I'm pretty much said my piece.
Satisfied?
Yeah.
Okay. Alex?
All in all, this was a good time, and I'm glad Wilhelm was able to meet with us.
Okay. Wilhelm?
It was great coming in. Be a guest on your podcast. I've had a blast, and I can't wait to listen to this and to spread the word about Mom's Basement among my friends.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Oh, I had a lot of fun, and I want to apologize to you guys and to our listeners for possibly butchering the podcast at the minute there with connection problems and my malfunctioning netbook. And promise everyone that next week, we'll be back up to our usual low standard of professionalism instead of our exceptionally low standard of professionalism for today. Okay. So all that said, I guess signing off. Alex, are you ready to unplug the microphone?
Hand is at the ready, just waiting for the Uh-oh. Call.
Uh-oh.
Oh, here it comes.
3, 2, 1. Ejecting microphone.
Ooh. Done.